ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, please be advised that this conversation contains content that might be upsetting. Please use discretion when listening.
John Paterson lived and breathed footy. Back in the 70s, John led the mighty Darwin Buffaloes to victory in an historic NTFL game. Off the field, John was taught to focus on the positive, to stand strong and to weather the storm. And this was put to the test in the early hours of Christmas Day, 1974, when John and his mum stood side by side, desperately holding their tin house together. John has become a prominent voice for the wants and needs of remote Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. John is affiliated with the Nullarkan people of Noongar. Dr. John Paterson, welcome to Conversations.
Happy NAIDOC Week.
John, you were born in Darwin. Now, your family home wasn't the run-of-the-mill house, was it?
No, it wasn't. Look, when we lived at Winelli, it was those Sydney William huts that housed predominantly defence forces when they were up here back in 1942, bombing of Darwin. That's what they accommodated their workforce and defence personnel in. So back in the day, Dad bought one of those after the war was over and defence was selling these dwellings. And we thought, yeah, that'd be a good start to reside in on the 5-acre block at Howard Springs today. So it's still standing and it's certainly proved that its structure really was tested during various cyclones. What are we now? It's nearly 60, 70-year old, that house, and still standing apart from a few renovations here and there. So I can certainly vouch for Sydney William Huts, Charlie.
They do the job. What memories do you have, John, of living out on the block?
There's lots of memories, many shindigs, many stories, particularly from my grandparents and mum and her siblings, into the recent years with Brother Bill and all the Retta Dixon mob, you know, that used to come out there and have shindigs for various celebrations, whether they birthdays or passing of a loved one, or when Bill came back from Western Australia from having a season of footy. So very fond memories. So that's the reason why we kept it.
And fond memories they are, but it was a difficult life for you because you didn't have electricity, you didn't have water. Your memories are great for it, but when you look back over it, they were tough times.
They certainly was, Charlie. And I reckon my claim to fame is I clean up all those other blocks in the street back in the day because there wasn't any power. We weren't on town water. So, you know, washing, we take it for granted. Now you just chuck all your clothes in a washing machine and put a bit of soap suds in there and away you go. But back in the day, we had to go and chop wood, fill up the copper from a well. We got water out of the well. You know, mum would put the clothes into the copper with a bit of, you know, Lux soap, I think it was, or Rinse soap back in the days. And then stirred the old coppers with the old broom handle, you know, to just make sure that the clothes were, while the fire was burning, so it was warm, you know, the water was warm and hopefully brought the whiteness back into our clothing through that process. Bathing, you know, again, water from the well, a 44-gallon drum chopped in half. And, you know, you went out there and filled it up and again got warm water from the copper, put your preferred temperature in the half 44-gallon drum and away you went. You sat in there and had a bogey, you know, had a wash. And for drinking water, we actually had a big steel container on the back of a trailer, which me and my dad used to go. It was a Sunday afternoon, evening sort of ritual that we'd go down to the intersection of Howard Springs Road and Stuart Highway there, and the old pipeline that came from Manton Dam back in the day that brought water to Darwin residents. There was a big tap, big hose that was supplied by government, I think, of the day, and everybody lined up and filled up their water drums or tanks or whatever water containers they had for drinking water.
Do you think this hard way of living prepared you for life?
Absolutely, Charlie. I think it really stood me in good stead. You know, the strong upbringing, discipline from my mum, particularly my bub, you know, making sure that we were at least going to school every day. I remember a couple of days that the school bus didn't rock up to pick us up. So, you know, we all sort of, our parents dropped us up the corner of Stuart Highway and Howard Springs Road again, and we walked to school following the old railway line, which led us right through to Darwin Primary School. We were going to Darwin Primary School in those days. And because the railway line came very close to Darwin Primary, so we walked. And it took us half a day from Howard Springs, just casually walking the railway line. And we all wanted to go to school and get the appropriate education.
Now, Darwin in the 60s, romantically, people look back over, it was a fabulous place and whatever. You were there. What was life like in the 60s in Darwin?
Well, hardly any traffic lights. There might have been one or two. But look, it was from memory, you know, I was born 58, so, you know, I would have been 6, 7 year old, that everybody almost knew everybody. It was very multicultural with various immigrants that came and lived in Darwin. It was just a very laid back, everybody knew everybody. Petrol was cheap, groceries were cheap, and it was hard yakka, you know, and I think for those of us that grew up in that era, really got a good upbringing, I believe. I just compare it with today with social media. I mean, that all that stuff wasn't around. So, you know, if you wanted to ring your mate, you'd jump on your bike and go and visit them up at their place, or they'd come down to your place. No cars, you know, you jumped on your push bike and you rode everywhere. So we were fit as, and the friendships were very, very strong.
John, your parents were strong, impressive people. Tell me about your folks.
Mum was born at Merrifield Station. My grandmother's was a very strong leader from the town of Nook or Roper River, southeast Arnhem Land, part of the Nullican clan. Grandfather is George Holtz. Him and his brothers and other ancestors had involvement in establishing the Darwin Botanical Gardens. In recent times, there was a Holtz Cottage, and there's other references to Lee Holtz for their contribution and service to establishing the botanical gardens back in those early days. So George Holtz was a drover. He was one of the brothers that worked in the pasture and loved cattle. So he was living and residing at Burnham, Larimar. For those that don't know, that's where that was the end point of the railway line between Darwin and Burnham back in particularly those defence era when army had to, you know, move all the equipment. And so my grandfather worked or resided in a Humpy outside of Larimar, and they drove cattle from around Hodson Downs, Nooka, that southeast Arnhem Land region, and obviously brought them back to Burnham to truck them onto the train and get them up to Darwin for further export or wherever they sent the cattle to. And he obviously met my grandmother at Nooka on one of those trips and asked whether she'd join him to help with, obviously, the cattle and obviously be his long-term partner. And then my mum was born at Burnham. She was one of the oldest. So.
How did your mum meet your dad?
My dad was obviously Scottish-English. His family migrated into Australia, into Brisbane in the early days. He drove trucks from Brisbane to Darwin would have been the early 50s. Mum was working at Government House at the time. He fell in love. I think he did two trips, and on his second trip he said to the truck haulage company owners, look, you better send somebody up here to pick this truck up because I ain't going back to Brisbane. I love Darwin. I want to make this place my home and live here for the rest of my life. So he took on taxi driving, and then one night Mum needed a lift home from Government House, and he was the taxi. He was driving the taxi that came and gave her a lift, and obviously love at first sight, or over a few months or weeks, whatever it took, and the rest is history. Here I am, me and my other two younger sisters, along with our older siblings. I mean, I just say that we've all had, even though we've got different surnames, we've all had the same mother, different fathers, the whole nine of us.
Now, some of your older brothers and sisters were taken away from your mum. What happened to your brothers and sisters?
Yeah, look, for various reasons, they were put into Red Dixon Home. Red Dixon Home in those days was established on Bagot Reserve before it moved up to Totem Road, you know, in recent times, where the mission was actually abolished and closed down. They did both places, that Bagot and that Totem Road sites. Bill was fortunate enough to... he was probably 15, 16 when recruiters came to Darwin and saw him play footy and offered him, you know, to go to Perth and continue his career in football with the West Perth Football Club. But my other older siblings, they actually stayed in Red Dixon until such time as my mum and my dad built this house at out at Howard Springs, and then have the space and the home to get them out of Red Addiction and bring us all together at Howard Springs. And
for those who don't know what Red Addiction's home was it a holding facility for children? What was the whole plan of it?
It was a institution like the bungalows and, you know, other faith group institutions where governments at the day, under the old Native Title Act, removed kids from, particularly, you know, the lighter-skinned kids from their parents, and many of them were born in the bush in those remote communities. But government at the time, you know, had this terrible policy when we reflect back now and look on the impact it's had on all of our brothers and sisters that spent time in these institutions and the abuse and all the ongoing stuff that's come out in a number of royal commissions and inquiries, how kids were treated in those institutions. Red Addiction was run by the Aboriginal Inland Mission faith group. Some of those other institutions run by Catholic Uniting Church and other faith groups. Red Addiction, yeah, was predominantly AIM.
John, not all the children were taken. How was that decision made?
Look, I think there were parents at the time that chose to put their kids into these institutes because they just didn't have the capacity. You know, they obviously didn't have their own home. You know, accommodation back in those days was probably very rough. I mean, I know, you know, myself living at the back of Kennans after we moved from Manelli, it was just corrugated iron and steel, dirt floors. And, you know, many of them were single parents and just didn't have the capacity, you know. They obviously had to get out and work. Childcare agencies were probably non-existent back in those days, so the next best thing, I suppose, or options for them was to put them in these institutions, hopefully, you know, to be cared for by these faith groups and their carers. Others were totally removed, you know. I mean, and then the abuse that they got was unacceptable, and we hear those horrific stories today as people share those through the various inquiries and other government processes. So Bill, for example, he saw it as an opportunity. He didn't want to reflect on the negatives. That's his choice. Others, you know, I know my older siblings that spent time in Red Addiction suffered terrible treatment and care. We don't try to talk about it openly. You know, they've had a brief discussion with us to share with us their experience in there. And so we choose just to focus on the positives, and because it is hurtful, you know. I mean, and we've seen that by many of those that have fronted the inquiries to share their stories and their experience in those institutions, what sort of terrible stress, social, emotional well-being impact that it's had on them, the intergenerational trauma that it's put on families, you know.
Mm. It must be difficult when the family get together and you say, like, you had family gatherings, some were institutionalised children and some were not. Some had good memories and some didn't have good memories. I mean, generally, is that not something that ever gets talked about when the group's together?
Yeah, I think it's more about celebrating now in the for those that are left with us now, Charlie. I mean, I know when we used to have the shindigs out at Howard Springs when I was 9 to 12-year-old, I was in charge, you know, of the music, the old vinyl record players with the old radiograms, I think they called them, you know, with the needle. You had to put the needle in the vinyl records to make sure it started at the right place. My memories of those shindigs were, and events and functions, was for them to just get away from those institutes and try and, you know, come together, even though, you know, they weren't biologically related, but they treated themselves, they saw themselves as brothers and sisters because they were part of that institution, you know, and they had to create their own family being and establish those relationships, which over all those years, very, very strong. It was, I know, you know, the Red Addiction family was a really strong, united family. You know, they supported each other through various challenges in life, and it was really heartening to see them come and listen to music, sing songs, and, you know, share whether they were coming in from, you know, working on those pastoral stations, or Bill coming up from Perth, you know, sharing his football experience at playing footy down there. and others, you know, obviously making a name for themselves in whatever career pathways that they chose to go into.
So the family group that was established was actually the group that lived in Redditdixon. What was their connection like with the other kids who didn't go to Redditdixon?
I think everybody embraced it, eh? Everybody. You know, I myself, I was fortunate enough not to experience the Redditdixon or those other institutes, you know, being one of those kids put into there. But again, we tried not to dwell on that because it, for some, like I keep saying, it was a terrible experience. So, you know, we talked about, okay, well, what are we going to do, you know? How are we going to, what's the plan for the next 12 months? What careers, you know, are people going, you know, are they changing their jobs? Are they moving interstate? You know, introducing, meeting other family members, you know, after knowing that they had other siblings. That maybe they were put in different institutions. So that was a time for celebration. As you'd be well aware, Charlie, that you know, stolen generation era had a terrible, terrible impact and a lot of hurt during that period. And we wanted to focus purely on the positiveness, you know, celebrations and birthdays and obviously sad times of passings, you know, sorry business. The priority of it was to, you know, really turn that negative into positives and celebrate the good times.
So you were not in Redditdixon, but you were with your mum when Cyclone Tracy struck Darwin.
Yeah, the eve of 74. So I left school. I needed to earn some pocket money. My brother-in-law had a building contract out at Large Amanda Building Houses, and he had to come in and get some supplies before, you know, Christmas. And he said, you know, you want to come out and be our labourer until Christmas time. We'll be back at Christmas. Yeah, I said, yep, no worries. So went out with my sister and brother-in-law and did the labouring out there. And because we were out there and, you know, the communication, you know, we had no access to ABC radio or any other radio or communication for that matter. So, you know, it was just full-on work, get up in the morning and go and do work. And we'd finished the contract and it was Christmas Eve that we got back in Adan. We all got paid and I thought, yeah, okay, well, got on to me mates from schoolmates and said, back in town, I'm cashed up, let's go and have a couple of beers in town and, you know, Christmas Eve, it's time for a celebration. So came in with my mates and after the nightclubs closed, our mate who was driving the car, Sober Bob, was driving down Bacon Road and he was swerving all over the place. We said, you sure you hadn't had a drink tonight, bro? And he said, no. There's a threatening of a cyclone. Cyclone Tracy's just out in the harbour. I said, what? And like I said, because we hadn't had any communication radio connection at Large Amarna at the time, I had no idea that Darwin was imminent of being hit by Cyclone Tracy. So we dropped our mate off in northern suburbs. The rest of us lived in the rural Harrod Springs area. I got dropped off at home at the old Sydney William Martin. I got home about 2 o'clock, I reckon, and by about 4:30, I reckon it was, in the morning, Mum come in, John, get up, we need your help. And I was a little bit seedy, having a couple of hours sleep, and I said, what's going on? Cyclone's coming, the cyclone's about to hit us, it's hitting us, can't you feel the wind? And it was just because it came in from the west after it went out to sea, and it backtracked, as you recall, Charlie, and it just hit, you know, it was just full on. I was looking down, you know, along the house, the old Sydney William Hutt, and there was just this big bow with the steel, and we all had our shoulders up against it, you know, to keep the pressure and hopefully prevent it from caving in or parts of the structure from being lifted and blown away, which would have then opened up gaps, which would have just allowed the force of the wind velocity to just smash the place, I believe. We watched our shed go flying in the wind. We watched neighbours, you know, infrastructure and sheds go flying. Trees were just bare strip, not a leaf on a tree, you know, for about a 30, well, it'd be more than that, Berry Springs, I reckon. I remember coming in from outside of Berry Springs. It was trees that had leaves on it, but as soon as you came, like, at that radius, It was just like someone had just got a big vacuum cleaner and vacuumed all the leaves off the trees. It was just bare.
But the old Sydney Williams hut
stood
solid.
I must say, Charlie, she's seen all the cyclones and everything thrown at it, and she's still standing to this day.
All right, let's talk about your life after school. You started off your professional career, John, as a garbologist, or, as it's known, a garbo. What led you there?
Well, Charlie, I was about to become a dad, February 1976. So I had to leave school, year 11, and go and get a job ASAP to support the new bub that was coming on. So somebody said, "Hey, Petter, they're looking for garbos." I said, "What's involved there?" He said, "Oh, you had to keep up. You got to keep up with the trucks. I mean, it's just non-stop. They just pull up and you throw your rubbish in the whole aluminium rubbish cans, bins back in those days, not this electronic arm stuff now where they just, you only need the driver in them." So there's about three guys that would work on each truck. So two runners at the back that would stand on these platforms, and when the truck pulls up, jumps off, gets the bins and chuck them in, and the truckie'd be off, the driver'd be off, and you got to keep up. It was fortunate I was playing footy and it was additional training, I saw it, for my football career. So, but it was good hours, five till we'd start early in the morning, nice and cool, and we'd be finished by 10 o'clock, so we had the rest of the day to ourselves. But it was something I really enjoyed. I did it for about, I reckon, 6 to 8 months, Charlie.
Well, that's pretty good. Now, were there any perks in the job?
There were. It was, I remember it was around at Christmas period. I reckon it was the 1975 Christmas period when I got the job, that old Darwinians, would come out with cartons or a bottle of, wine and say, "Hey, guys, thanks for, continuing picking up our garbage for all these years. And here, look, here's a bit of an appreciation for your work." So cartons of beer. We had, all sorts of gifts given to us by very generous Territorians at the time. And, it sort of gave us a bit of a motivation to keep going and clean up the suburbs during that period. So it was a lot of fun.
After working for some time as a garbologist, your life was about to take an about turn. You entered the world of Aboriginal affairs. John, talk us about the transition. How did that actually happen, that you went from being the garbo to working, I think, with the Northern Land Council?
So it would have been late 78, Charlie. I did garbologist and I did some laundry time at Royal Darwin Hospital in the lead-up of towards the end of 1978. And I don't know whether you recall, but back then they had these but Northern Territory Public Service would have these public exams. You go and sit a test, and from that they would see whether you had any potential or was that somebody that they were looking for in the Northern Territory government at the time. And so I sat one of those, and I thought I probably failed because I didn't complete year 12 and have the appropriate skill sets that they were after. But out of the blue, this phone call came through it would have been just prior to Christmas 78, by the Northern Territory Public Service, asking whether I'd come in for an interview with the Chief Minister's Department back in the day. So I did that and was successful in securing a entry clerk position, AR1 they called them back in those days. And I started with the Northern Territory Public Service Chief Minister's Department Office of Aboriginal Liaison on the 1st of January 1979.
I can add here a little bit, because I remember what was happening at that time. Paul Evrian was the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, and he made a speech to the Legislative Assembly about a 5-year plan to improve the lives of Aboriginal people. And one of the things he was asking for was that there was more Aboriginal people recruited into the public service. So that was what people were trying to do, was to try and get people who showed, some ability to actually get them into the public service. Obviously, you sat the exam and you were seen as someone with that potential. Yeah. So that, we should never forget that Paul Evrian, the Chief Minister at the time, drove that. And it was fairly innovative. I mean, no one else was doing anything like that around Australia. This was soon after the Northern Territory got self-government.
Self-government.
And it was their new plan. So
yeah. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that, Charlie, but that explains why a number of Indigenous Territorians ended up getting these base grade entry, even though at base grade it was a foot in the door.
Podcast, broadcast, this is Conversations with Charlie King.
John, you were talking about your start in the public service, but at the same time you were a pretty good footy player. What happened on that special day the Buffaloes won the NTFL Premiership?
Yeah, sure, Charlie. And as you're aware, Buffaloes has a big support base here in Darwin, and we had people working in Park Territory Parks and Wildlife. We were looking at mascots for the day, and one of them came up with the idea that we'd get a baby buffalo heifer. That could be our mascot to run out, under tight control of our supporters to ensure that the buffalo didn't escape or run amok. Anyway, the buffalo arrived in the back of a trailer and got him off and hooked up the ropes. And baby buffaloes, as you were, Charlie, their horns aren't well developed. And this one was a little heifer. And so his horn was about that big. Anyway, the guy in charge tied these ropes up, and I know one of them definitely was Bigfoot Babbin, Donald Babbin. They said, "Foot, Bigfoot, you got to hang on to this rope now, and you got to take control of this buffalo because he'll get away, he'll run out there." So anyway, and I'm being the captain, I'm right behind him, I've got to lead the team out in the Gardens Oval. And away we went, Yep, time to run out, threw the banner, and anyway, the buffalo come loose, the ropes just slipped off the horns, And this buffalo got loose around the Gardens Oval, and it was just chaotic. It was fun. I mean, the guy obviously managed it very well. He had a good risk management plan in place to capture this buffalo and get him back on the trailer. But it was just a great entertainment, pre-grand final entertainment,
That's right. It was pre-match entertainment.
It was pre-match entertainment. Yeah, never forget that. Jeff Bates, credit to him as well, the coach, very tough coach on us, and he obviously had the best team on the day, and we led from first bounce to the last bounce.
Do you remember the feeling you had when you actually won the premiership?
It was just unbelievable, Charlie. And I can still see myself, the holy grail of football ovals here in the Northern Territory being the Gardens Oval and being captain, a premiership captain, standing up, with the premiership trophy with Batesy that was presented by the AFL president, I think, on the day. And just with all the buffalo mob, like I say, it was, I think that particular day we had one of the biggest crowds at football. They were hanging from the rafters. And remember, they had the commentator's box, the brick building, and they had the canteen underneath, and all the commentators had to go up, walk up the stairs and broadcast, do their broadcast from up top. They were hanging off there as well, and the whole surroundings of Gardens Oval at that time was just chockers. Amazing, amazing. And just by everybody running onto the field, after the siren went and joining in the celebrations, just one hell of an event that I'll never, ever forget.
These are incredible moves for a man who was brought up in a little tin shed and then gradually found his way into the public service and then the Northern Land Council. But even greater changes were about to come for you, because you then got involved with the bus ride that took people from around Australia to protest in Sydney. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right, Charlie. I mean, as you're aware, the Northern Land Council has a role and responsibility for implementing the views and opinions of traditional owners from right around the Northern Territory, those that had their land claims handed back to them, and to represent Aboriginal people when they come together with other land councils from right around the country to undertake the appropriate advocacy and lobby processes that needed to take place as they saw fit. So at that time, in 1988, as we're all aware, was the bicentennial celebrations, and they had a big event, a week's program in Sydney, where they had a lot of reenactment of the tall ships, etc., coming into Botany Bay, and it was the land councils from right around the nation saw fit that they needed to get a message to the Australian public that there was no such thing as terra nullius. Aboriginal people lived in Australia for, thousands of years. There's enough evidence now, anthropological evidence, that confirms that. And so they wanted to send a message to government that, that Aboriginal people should deserve the appropriate recognition and rights to be the ancestors of this country. So we planned a trip and organised under the leadership of Dr. Aikid to take a number of Aboriginal people from the Northern Territory, from all parts right across the Northern Territory, down to Sydney to participate in the campaign. We left Bees Creek, the footy owl there, Sun Districts. You know, there's about eight buses and a couple of troopies and a big truck to chuck all our swags. And
I mean, this was a big trip, and I mean, it was heading to a protest rally. You picked up people along the way as well, but some people actually passed away. I mean, this was on the trip, but this was a difficult journey to take. Well, what are your memories of the trip from down to Sydney?
Yeah, you did right, Charlie. So in Katherine, we picked up all the Kimberley mob that came across and joined the convoy in Katherine. We went to Tenor Creek. We picked up some of the Western Queensland groups that came across the Barkly and joined us in Tenor Creek. Alice Springs, big contingent there because Central Land Council, representatives joined the convoy as well. And, it was unfortunate when it got, I reckon it was around about Port Augusta, one of our elders that was on the bus passed on us, which really rocked us, really, really sad. So that delayed, you know, a couple of us. We wanted to make sure that we provide the appropriate support and assistance to the gentleman who passed and make sure that, you know, he was given all the respect and dignity that, and support and assistance to ensure that, you know, he was cared for or his body was transported home for families to obviously undertake the burial proceedings. But very sad. It put a dampener on us. But look, as we continued on the journey, at night we pull up and again, you know, get together as a group to express our sadness and sympathy, but then to also focus on, okay, we've got to get to Sydney, to La Perouse, because it's a big campaign that we've got to attend to. So we were on a pretty tight time frame.
What happened when you arrived in Sydney? How
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, so the convoy, yeah, by this time, because in Port Augusta we met some of the mob that came across from the bottom of Western Australia, and some of the South Australian mob came up and joined us. And the convoy, I reckon, would have been about 20, 30, you know, these 8-12-seater buses.
Wow.
Big convoy it was, and there's photos around us going across, I think, the flat country around New South Wales, Hay and those sorts of places, you know, those communities, rural communities. Anyway, we finally liaised with New South Wales Police, and they met us at a place called Wittagong, just outside of Sydney, and they provided the appropriate escort into La Perouse. And I can recall, you know, I was in the passenger seat of the bus as we pulled into La Perouse, and the amount of people, First Nations people, along the street of the entrance into La Perouse, just applauding, you know, because they obviously heard the stories of, you know, the passing and how far we'd come, you know. It was about a 5-6 day road trip back in those days. We didn't want to, you know, speed or do it in a fast pace. But the excitement, the applaud, the tears that flowed from everybody as we drove into the gates of, or the entry gates of La Perouse, and then obviously, you know, it was hugs and kisses and high fives once we parked the vehicles and rejoiced with thousands and thousands of other people at the time.
Were you motivated by what came out of Sydney, because you took a bit of a break when you came back to the Territory? You went off and studied in Western Australia?
Yeah, that's right, Charlie. Yep, secured a scholarship that allowed me to go to uni to undertake studies. I chose Edith Cowan University because they had a course there titled Bachelor of Social Science, Human Service Management. And the content and the units part of that program, that course, was something that I was looking for, you know, something. I wanted to be multi-skilled. I wanted to be right across all the human service portfolios, whether it's education, health, law, employment, housing, you know. This course it attracted me, and it wasn't offered anywhere else.
And then you returned to the Territory and you'd joined ATSIC.
So the ATSIC elections were 1993 to 1996. I was elected there, and then somebody suggested that I should also put my nomination in for the ATSIC Commissioner. So I did that, and it was conducted by the Australian Electoral Commission. It was a preferential voting system. There's a field, you know, a Melbourne Cup field that ran for the position, and I thought I had Buckley's. But as it turned out, after all the preferences were distributed and final count was made, and I was announced the successful commissioner for ATSIC top end zone, which then took me into office at the ATSIC commissioner office from 1993 to 1996.
So ATSIC, its life wasn't that long, and there's lots of people may comment about what it achieved and what it didn't achieve. You were there, you were involved with it. What was achieved by ATSIC? I mean, when you look back at it, what do you think? Was it a good thing?
Absolutely. I think politicians at the federal level even came to a conclusion that it was probably an error for governments to abolish ATSIC. The advantage of ATSIC I saw was that it was a one-stop shop. First Nations people could go there right around the country and get all their issues dealt with, or, you know, they were able to go and present or raise their issues with bureaucrats, particularly for whatever reasons they may have wanted to visit the ATSIC offices. And ever since then, I believe, you know, it was then all those portfolios were all given back to our respective government departments, which made it really difficult then for people to go and have their issues dealt with, because when you're faced with the disadvantage that most of our mob are faced with, there's layers and layers and layers of issues, you know. If you don't have good housing, that's going to lead to poor health, poor education, unemployment. So, you know, expecting someone to run around to all the various different government departments, raising those concerns or getting it addressed by government bureaucracy was one of the unacceptable time-wasting, and it just, people gave up in the end. It was just too much. They would prefer to just go to one place like ATSIC was and get those issues raised and dealt with.
Those issues you were fighting for back in the 90s, has much changed now?
Charlie, I think in all my recent working at the national level now, I think one portfolio that we can really put our hands on our heart and say that we've made some improvement has been the health sector. I mean, they're very organised, well-structured in terms of getting grassroots issues up through the respective jurisdictional structures, and then at a national level, you know, through NACHO, which then has the has access to all the ministers, you know, health ministers. They have a national board that can advocate and influence, you know, governments to address the number of health issues. And we see that day-to-day, enormous issues that are impacting on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in this country. So some of the lesser successful issues that I've observed, education. You know, there are some success stories, but, you know, when I go remote communities and I hear stories that, you know, somebody completing year seven at a remote primary school, when they do the proper assessment, they're almost equivalent to a grade four or five student in suburbia, you know, primary schools, which is really sad. We want them to be able to complete it at the right standard of education level, grade seven particularly, and then going into those middle schools and the higher senior schools, middle senior schools that education structures have these days, and then hopefully on to university, you know, and then get all those skills and learnings to be competitive once they enter into the workforce.
So after ATSIC, you found your way into the health field and actually got involved with AMSANT, which is the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance Northern Territory. You became the head of that organisation. And so what are some of the changes that you've been involved with at AMSANT that you're most proud of?
Yeah, Charlie, it was only a couple of years into the job, and the Australian government, you'll recall, under John Howard government, made a decision in Parliament to roll out the Australian government intervention in 2007. The announcement was made, and then it was, you know, implementation, putting in all the various structures and systems and processes that required the implementation of the intervention. One of those proposed measures that they wanted to have part of the intervention was to have these compulsory child sexual health checks.
And now the Aboriginal Health Leadership said, this breaches all declarations from the United Nations right across to, you know, all the other instruments, government instruments that pertain to the to children, you know, right around the world, including Australia. So, you know, I was out there in the media totally opposing, calling on the government to remove this. And thankfully that common sense prevailed and it was removed to just having, you know, the normal child health checks, which the Aboriginal community control health sectors originally developed, you know, and designed for making sure that child health checks were being undertaken on a regular basis. So that was one of the big challenges 2 years into the job. So we had success there until more recently, you know, the pandemic.
Now, you were a voice that very clearly was saying more needed to be done for remote communities when the pandemic hit. Were you being heard?
I think so, Charlie. Look, 2021, it sort of started to get into Australia, into the borders, you know, international tourists, you know, travelling at that time and bringing the virus into Australia. And then once we had confirmation that it was widespread, it was spreading at a rate of knots, you know, this is one of the fastest spreading viruses, particularly to, you know, populations, disadvantaged populations that might have had chronic illnesses. You know, Aboriginal communities were at high risk. If it ever broke into those communities, then it would almost, we were saying it was going to be detrimental or have a huge detrimental impact on our population if it ever got into remote communities the way it did.
People were terrified.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Charlie. So we needed to get influence government. So APONT collectively came together and called on governments at all levels that we needed to close the borders. If there was one way to try and contain this virus and reduce the risk of it getting into the territory and getting into our remote communities, then we needed to, you know, shut the borders, the territory borders to other jurisdictions, unless there were some certain criteria, you know, you're either a specialist or doctor or health worker. But it was an effective measure. Traditional owners were advocating. They were ringing, Paddo, you better get on and tell them, fellas, we don't want visitors anymore out here, you know? We don't want people visiting. We just want to lock our community up until we're confident that the virus was being dealt with and that appropriate vaccinations that is the other big challenge, Charlie, with vaccinating our mob, you know? There's all the scaremongering stuff going on, so...
Well, misinformation made it really, really difficult. I mean, it was already a difficult thing to do, but how much harder did that make it for the services?
Obviously, you know, we had smart leaders in the health sector, you know, community and our doctors and nurses that work in our sector. So we had to combat, you know, we had to come up with strategies and ideas and messaging to combat all that negative stuff that was going on in community. So, you know, that required, you know, using our interpreters, getting posters made in appropriate languages, you know, that all the different communities could easily understand, getting our interpreters and speakers on the radio, on you know, YouTube, little snippets, you know, and I might add there was some really deadly and creative messaging going on and that really got the message across, short, sharp and precise manner. So that really helped. I believe that was probably one of our most effective strategies of getting that message out to our most remotest communities and population. If it wasn't for the strong support and advocacy work of our Aboriginal leadership here in the Northern Territory, would have been in a worse situation, I believe.
And you were given a nickname.
Yeah, well, I tend to, you know, get a laugh from it, but they said, oh, Paddy, you've done really diddly at keeping this COVID at bay. We're going to give you a nickname of King COVID.
Thoroughly deserved.
And Donna Archie is Queen COVID.
Oh, my God. Now, can we go back to the health issues? There are many health issues out there that you continue to deal with. How difficult was it in having to work on some of those really serious cases, and how much success did you have?
That's an interesting question, Charlie, you raised, and very pertinent one. I mean, during COVID, all the attention was focusing on keeping COVID at bay and getting, you know, vaccination rates up. So whilst we're dealing, and rightly so, giving priority to COVID, many of our clients who had those ongoing chronic illnesses, you know, were also sort of put on the back burner, so to speak, because the attention just wasn't, and the workforce just wasn't there to keep, you know, COVID at bay and also continue the day-to-day primary health care for our mobs. So, again, I think we did that and we dealt with that effectively well. But, you know, there was a big catch-up, a lot of catching up to do once we got COVID at bay and reduced the infectious rates, you know. We then had to turn our attention on to clients that obviously have higher rates of chronic illnesses. You know, there's a large population of that. Renal dialysis, as we see, is obviously on the improve, big numbers. You know, the tsunami is here in regards to renal failure and people requiring renal dialysis treatment. Cardiovascular disease, rheumatic heart disease, these are all preventable diseases, Charlie.
Mm.
And, you know, we keep saying to governments, we need the appropriate political leadership, we need the appropriate government investment. If we're going to get on top of it, if we're going to get on the closing the life expectancy gap for our men and women here in the Northern Territory who have the highest life expectancy gap to other Australians, brothers and sisters, non-Indigenous around the country, is just unacceptable. And we can change that, Charlie. We can definitely change it if we get the genuine commitment from all levels of government.
Mm. We've been talking about your professional life, but behind it all is a strong family man. The family you've made is a blended one. Can you talk us through it?
Yeah, sure, Charlie. My first wife was Christine Christofferson, and we had four kids, two older girls, two younger sons, and then marriage didn't work out as well as we wanted to and expected. So we divorced. I then remarried to Cindy, and we've got two girls, two older girls. Together we've got six kids. Christine was unfortunately diagnosed with an aggressive cancer that took her life eventually. I reflect back now and, you know, obviously not seeing the grandkids grow up and our kids, you know, mature into fine adults and good parents and enjoying all those celebratory occasions and events. And prior to passing, we'd go up and visit her while she's in the hospice there and... you know, we had a few words, you know, last words to say to each other and just said we, you know, we still loved each other and cared for one another and that I continue to be a good dad. But look, we're a strong family. We celebrate all the anniversaries, even her passing, and go to a special spot down at East Point and have a barbecue there, all the family and friends. And, yeah, she'll... never be forgotten.
What's next for you, John?
Gee whiz, Charles. Look, while I'm healthy and fit and, you know, still got the fire in the belly, I'll continue to do the advocacy work, you know, all our mob want me to do. And until somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, Paddo, that's enough now, you know, you can hang up the boots, then... but until that time comes, I love what I'm doing. Love what I'm doing. I love our mob for all their support and friendship that they've given me over the years, particularly my family for, you know, their ongoing support. I do a lot of things. I do a lot of travel. I'm at a lot of meetings, and if it wasn't without their support, and they assess me as well, you know, on weekends. We have family little cups of teas and morning teas, and it's a time of reflection, and if I've said something wrong or done something wrong, they soon let me know and get me back on track. But as people, working with other leaders as well, it's not about me, Charlie, it's about you. You promote and all the stuff, you know, in the media that you do well and you make us all accountable, you know, and your work you do on a voluntary basis as well. We're all doing our bit, hopefully, to bring a better future for our mob.
Indeed, I agree with you. Dr. John Paterson, thank you for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks, Charlie. Greatly appreciated.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
What's it like to be there in person at a moment that shapes history?
We turned around from the command post and then there was rounds zinging over our head then.
I had some friends that were just like, okay, I've got someone hiding in my car. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm just going to drive.
You know your life is never going to be the same again because you're suddenly aware. Oh, I knew I'd never have another day like that.
G'day, Kirk Docker here. I've been working on a new show for ABC TV called I Was Actually There. For the show, we've found people who are on the ground at nation-defining moments and brought them together to tell those stories. For our podcast, we're doing things a bit differently by focusing on just one person and sharing more of their story in gripping, vivid detail. You'll hear what it was like to survive the Boxing Day tsunami.
I immediately went to a narrative in my head of, you know, what could this be? Maybe there was a bulldozer out of control or a truck or something like that, because that's how it felt. It didn't feel like water.
And what it was like to be trapped underground for 14 days in the Beaconsfield mine collapse.
When you're underground, you can't see 2 millimetres in front of you. The darkness of underground is just black.
Follow the show on the ABC Listen app to get every episode.